Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Here's the regular Sunday roundup of news from all over the world, reported by NBC's staff of American commentators abroad. These men who cover the news as it happens are now ready to tell you directly the important events of the past few hours. And for first-hand news from the Middle East, we turn now to the staff member in Ankara, Turkey.
Hello, NBC. This is Martin Agronsky calling from Ankara, Turkey. The renewal of the German southern offensive in Russia, which the Nazis now claim has carried them along the coast of the Sea of Azov to within 70 miles of Rostov, remains a central point of interest for this part of the world. The way we see the German plan of campaign from here is that the southern Nazi armies have a double objective. One, to drive dead east with one great force through Rostov to the Caspian Sea. Two, with a second great army to wheel south from Rostov and the River Don Basin and drive all out for the Soviet Caucasus. By cutting across the neck of land between the Sea of Azov and the Caspian to their first objective, the Nazis would equally be cutting across the transportation arteries tying the Caucasus to European Russia, the arteries along which flow the lifeblood of Russia's mechanized army, the oil of Baku, and also the arteries which carry the war materials of Great Britain and the United States from the Caucasus. By driving up into the mountains of the Caucasus themselves, the Nazis would be moving to their second objective, and it is perhaps the main strategic objective of the present phase of World War II.
That is?
First, the oil of Baku, which supplies over 80% of Russia's needs and would put Hitler for years to come beyond the worry for oil. And second, possession of the Caucasian bases, beyond which lie the oil of Iraq and Iran, the entire British African Empire, and finally the juiciest plum of conquest in all the world, India. The Caucasus presents a considerable defensive barrier. The Caucasian Mountains are a good deal like America's High Sierra Range. The peaks run up to 16 and 17,000 feet, and in the mountain passes, the snow fog piles up into 20 to 30 foot drifts. Furthermore, unlike the Sierras, the Caucasian Mountains have no decent roads at all, and throughout the winter, practically all freight traffic moves by rail. The Soviets would undoubtedly be able to cut the railroad line at any number of strategic points. A Russian railroad engineer, whose job for the past 15 years has been Caucasian transport, assured me recently there are at least 100 tunnels cut through the mountains where a blast of dynamite would bring an entire mountain down to sit across the railroad track. In addition, the winters are severe, with a thermometer hovering around zero and below for a good 4 months of the year. And blizzard after blizzard, it chokes up the passes between the mountains. The transport and military experts generally seem positive the Germans will never be able to occupy the Caucasus during the winter. The danger time is universally set for spring. Unless Hitler decides to take the only alternative road, that is to attack from Bulgaria across Turkey, and this seems unlikely, the Red Army of the Caucasus and the British Army of the Middle East have at least until March 1942 to prepare for what may be the most decisive battle of the war. I'm reliably informed that the British and Russians are doing everything in their power to ensure they will be ready when the German push comes. Observers arriving here from Iran and Iraq report that the flow of American and British war materials routed through the Persian Gulf from India and America is steadily increasing. Both Iraq and Iran up to the Soviet frontiers are described as crawling with British engineers and transport. In Iran, the Soviet and British staffs are in constant contact. In the British and Red Army field headquarters in Iran, staff officers study day in and day out sheafs of messages that originate in Moscow, in Tiflis, in Simla, in Cairo, in London, and sometimes in Washington. The job that may someday await the British and Red Armies of the Middle East and Caucasus has every prospect of being one of the vital strategic jobs of this war. The Army Britain and Russia must build up to defend the Caucasian barrier and the Middle Eastern hinterland that lies behind will hold in its hands the fate of Africa and India as well as that of Russia. If its original task of defense is accomplished successfully, the British and Russian armies will have before them a prospect that could even provide the turning point of the war, the prospect of establishing a common land front with Germany, where the anti-Axis powers could, for the first time since the war began, hope to start an offensive. As far back as last February, months before the Russo-German war, a British general with whom I spoke visualized this possibility. He told me, I quote, "From a strategic point of view, the Caucasus is a great defensive barrier, and it can be much more than that. If the Soviets ever become our allies, and Britain and Russia together have the strength, the Caucasus provides the most feasible front in the world from which to begin an offensive action against the German army."
That was Ankara, Turkey. Now for news from another neutral country, this one in the heart of warring Europe, we turn now to Bern, Switzerland.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles Lanius in Bern. Sunday in the East meant a day of desperate, bloody fighting for German and Russian soldiers slugging it out before the gates of Moscow. According to reports coming in here tonight, the furious battles being fought on three sides of Moscow haven't let up in intensity for the past 24 hours. The Germans driving in with every offensive weapon available, and the Russians slowly giving way, doggedly defending every foot of ground, using every trick of war in a supreme effort to stop the invaders. The actual military situation today is confused, but two facts emerge from the tangled, contradictory reports coming from the German and Russian capitals. The only clear conclusion that can be drawn from messages from the fighting zone itself is that the Soviet defense of Moscow is stiffening, and the crushing German advance has slowed down. The Russians claim that a counterattack on the right wing of the Moscow front in the area of Kalinin has been effective. The German losses are said to be heavy, and one dispatch says that 800 of Hitler's men have gone west in the past 24 hours. On the left wing in the Vyazma sector, the Germans have driven a wedge into Soviet positions, but according to Moscow, only at a great price in men and material. Fighting still seems to be going on in this district, although the Germans have, as on several other occasions, announced the battle has ended in a definite and decisive victory for them. The severest fighting is reported in the center in the region of Moyest, where the Germans are hammering away at the Russian defenses with their best troops and their heaviest arms. Here, the Russians report that their own losses, as well as the German losses, are enormous. There are no fresh reports from the Leningrad area, so it's assumed here that there's been little change in the general situation. Now, a second significant fact is that in spite of the assurances by German officials to the people that the war in the East is practically finished, German military commanders are preparing for a long winter of hard going on the vast Russian steppes. The army heads have announced that all the necessary equipment for the cold Russian winter is ready for the troops. There's snow already in the north around Leningrad, and Moscow reports cold rains in the central section. Meanwhile, the defenders of the Russian capital are waiting for the final German attack. Most of the governmental offices have been transferred to towns in the interior, but stories here indicate that Moscow will be defended to the last. Dictator Joe Stalin and his military staff are still in the city, and the impression given by Moscow is that they won't consider leaving until they are certain the capital is lost. Back in the interior, across the Urals and in Siberia, Red Commissars and army officers are said to be hard at work raising new armies, which they hope will be ready for fighting by spring. So it's evident that even if Moscow falls, the war will go on, and it means that even if the Germans successfully occupy Western Russia, they'll still have a big job on their hands before they can turn back to the West and their arch-enemy, England. Tonight, a dispatch from Bucharest announces that Marshal Antonescu has decreed the annexation of Odessa to the territory in the south to come under the administration of Romania. From Paris comes a story of a German court-martial of another Frenchman charged with illegal possession of arms. This is Charles Lanius in Bern returning you to NBC in New York.
Next, to the capital of the British Empire.
This is London, Fred Bates speaking. In daylight sweeps over northern France today, the British encountered no German plane. A Sunday meeting of workshop stewards, claimed to represent over 300,000 workers in key factories, decided to telegraph the Prime Minister, demanding the opening up of a Western front against Hitler as quickly as possible. They pledged themselves to maintain their efforts to increase production to a degree that will guarantee both the maintenance of such a front and material aid to Russia. I've just come back from a short trip to Norfolk. It's a low-lying agricultural county on the east coast. In parts, it's like Holland, with pastures lying below sea level, streams that might be canals, cattle and windmills. There's a Dutch influence there, too. A Hollander promoted the beet sugar industry. At first, he couldn't interest the Norfolk farmers in sugar beets, so he bought land where he could, raised his own beets, and today it's the chief product of the county. Farmers will tell you that the sugar beet saved certain districts. I went to a meeting in Norwich on Saturday, when Mr. Hudson, the Minister of Agriculture, spoke to, I think, 600 or 700 Norfolk farmers. He'd already asked them to plow under another 20,000 acres of grassland this year. Well, they plowed under 39,000 acres. He'd assigned them other quotas for planting. They've got more acreage under each of these than he asked for. He knew what they were going to ask him, and he knew he couldn't give it. They were going to ask that their young men be left on the land, at least enough to help with the heavy work. They did ask it, and he had to refuse. Men were needed for other work, and they'd have to use more and more women as a land army. He was blunt, although understanding. These keen-eyed men of Norfolk didn't like what he had to tell them, but they understood, and it seemed respected him for speaking bluntly. They pledged more of everything, more food, more of themselves. I heard a good deal in Norfolk about people from home. Both the minister and Mr. Mansfield, who's the director of the university farm at Cambridge, and others, talked about the visit there of Mr. Appleby and Mr. Evans of the Department of Agriculture in Washington. They hope to see them again, and they hope Tom Campbell will come back again to swap farming ideas. There's a great work going on here. The Ministry of Agriculture set up a War Agriculture Committee. Each section of this country has a district subcommittee of the main body. These subcommittees are local farmers, men of the neighborhood, and a representative of the Farm Laborers Union. They're aided by graduate scientific agriculturalists who are themselves farmers. These committees stimulate production in wartime. If a local committee considers that a farm is not being properly worked through whatever cause, they investigate. It may be ignorance, or indolence, or illness, or worry. Short-handed though they are today, they help the inefficient farmer to improve his land and his output. Mostly, the helping hand does the trick, sets a man going again. If all efforts fail, the man's lease is terminated. He's given a year's notice and paid a year's rent as indemnity, and an active farmer's put on his land. There are many cases under this system where not only land has been saved, but a man who was discouraged, down and out, before these friendly advisors called to help him. Mr. DeValera, speaking today at Wexford, warned Ella that there was a high probability she'd be involved in the war. He said he feared the Irish people did not fully realize the danger and were only preparing in fits and starts instead of working all the time. We return you now to the National Broadcasting Company, New York.
That was London. Back onto the continent of Europe for our next report from an NBC staff member abroad. This one is Paul Archinard. He speaks to you from Vichy, France.
Hello, NBC. This is Paul Archinard in Vichy. After 3 days of reflection over Marshal Pétain's sentence of Daladier, Blum, Gamelin, and others, the public fully realizes that this judgment is not an end, but only a first stage on the road to a definite trial by the Court of Rion. In the meantime, the condemned men remain in their respective prisons. It is even said that they will not be moved to the fortress prison in the mountains before several months. Attention just now is focused on General Weygand's presence in Vichy. He has been with the marshal much of the time and has conferred with the supply, the production, and the finance secretaries. Any visit to Vichy on the part of Weygand always arouses public interest, for he is identified with the French colonial empire as a unit. That's all that can be said about Weygand's stay in Vichy for the moment. Meanwhile, Minister of Agriculture Cazio pronounced another radio appeal to the farmers this afternoon. Minister Cazio reiterated his plea of a year ago, asking farmers for a maximum effort. He pointed out that if perfidious voices, as he called them, incited farmers to reduce their production to a bare necessity, there might be trouble. The tragic repercussions of a general famine would result, he said. And even the most humble would run the risk of seeing their property and even their person threatened. Implying, we assume, that starving non-farmers might not always respect the laws of proprietorship. In fact, minor incidents have already occurred. A few nights ago, prowlers raided the chicken coop of a large farm in the south and left only one rooster. He had a little cardboard sign tied around his neck, which read, "Since midnight, I've been a widower." Then again, news articles condemn the growing practice of stealing cats. It seems that many people are pilfering other persons' pets and converting them into synthetic rabbit stews. One man was fined 1,500 francs recently because his victim turned out to be a particularly valuable Angora tabby. Well, I haven't seen any cats on sale in the market yet, but I have seen crows and squirrels, which people snatch up for want of anything better. Minister Cazio does not give us all the reasons for the shortage of food products. He does point out that the lack of fertilizer is one cause for mediocre crops, that the want of binding cord or substitutes is making harvests both difficult and wasteful, and that exhausted copper sulfate stocks imperil future potato and wine crops. This partly explains why the government asked for old pots and pans made of copper, brass, and other non-ferrous metals. These to be converted into plumbing fixtures, electric wirings, and other necessities, including copper sulfate. For the same purpose, many statues of bronze and other alloys will be removed from public parks in France and melted. But in some cases, this will not be a very great loss to art in general. And this is all from Vichy tonight.
Now, before we go overseas again, let's get some news from here at home. Here's news in our own capital, reported by Borkage from the newsroom in Washington.
Borkage talking from Washington. Another weekend is passing without the expectation of any immediate event which will change the course of the nation, but nevertheless with a very definite feeling of suspense here. Once again, the capital is looking two ways, toward the east and to the west. Toward the Battle of the Atlantic, in which we are definitely a partisan now, nursing our first casualty, that wounded destroyer. And toward the Pacific, too, which might, of course, become a battleground later. It is generally conceded by diplomats here that there is a close connection between the resignation of the Canoyo government and the torpedoing of the Kearney, not, of course, an actually planned one or an executed as part of a plan, but nevertheless, the two events are closely interrelated. The torpedoes centered attention on the spot where the Nazis want the Japanese to think the American fleet is located, but where the Nazis want the fleet located and occupied is in the other direction, in the Pacific. The other day, I heard some very interesting observations from one of Britain's experts on aviation, one of the few men who flew in the last war, and in this one, too. He took part in the Battle of Britain. Something he said seemed to tie into the present diplomatic situation, which may affect the course of this nation. Mr. Courtney, this British flyer, former flyer, said that Goering lost the Battle of Britain because he violated an old rule of warfare. He attempted a frontal attack on a strongly fortified objective, an objective whose firepower was greater than his own. In the case of the Battle of Britain, the greater firepower consisted chiefly in the heavily armed and armored Spitfires and Hurricanes, the fighting planes. So now Hitler realizes that he can't win the Battle of Britain unless he can make a flank attack. In the air, of course, a flank attack has really to be a different means of attack. And one means might be a blockade of the British Isles. Such a blockade would be hardly possible, it has been pointed out here, with the American Navy in the Atlantic. It might not even be possible with no more active participation than we are offering at present. But the point is this. Hitler's diplomatic effort right now, according to observers here, is bent on getting the American Navy out of the way, and hence this Nazi pressure which has brought about the crisis in Japan. That's all we have time for from Washington, and thanks very much.
Now, a report from the Atlantic outpost of the United States. Go ahead, Reykjavik, Iceland. Hello, Reykjavik, Iceland. NBC Newsroom in New York calling. Come in, please. Regrettably, conditions beyond our control prevent our bringing you a report at this time from Reykjavik, Iceland. Before we continue with this roundup of international reports and go to the Far East, let us bring you some bulletins just received here in the NBC newsroom, and here is one that has just come in from Moscow. The Russians officially admit that the Germans are 57 miles from Moscow at one point. An official Soviet announcement says that the Red Armies defending Moscow have, however, beaten off fierce new German attacks. The Russian Army newspaper Red Star says the Germans have been driven out of three towns west of Moscow. The towns are not identified. The Moscow radio says that large numbers of Siberian and Mongolian troops are being rushed westward to reinforce the Russian armies defending Moscow. It stated that some of these fresh troops already have taken their places in the Mozhaisk sector, 60 miles west of the Soviet capital. Especially heavy fighting is mentioned in this area, and also in the vicinity of Kalinin, 95 miles northwest of Moscow. Official Russian dispatches admit that the Red Army has been forced back in one sector, but declare that German losses are enormous. The Russians are said to have recaptured two villages. The Moscow radio says that the city's suburbs are being converted into improvised forts, with anti-tank guns and machine guns installed in every home. The battlefield is blanketed with snow. One broadcast declares the Germans face the prospect of being overtaken by winter. Here's a bulletin in from Peshawar, India. Britain and Russia are believed to have started a move to get German and Italian nationals out of Afghanistan. The radio at Kabul, Afghanistan, says that the Axis nationals are preparing to leave. Britain and Russia forced Italians and Germans to leave Iran, you will recall, in order to strengthen their position on the flank of the Russian and German front. Afghanistan is a country neighboring Iran, and the Allies may be adopting the same policy there. Paris. German authorities announced today that a resident of a Paris suburb was shot by a firing squad yesterday on charges of possessing firearms. This was the fifth execution of the week and the 80th announced thus far. This latest announcement means that 20 persons have been killed by German or Italian executioners in the last 48 hours. 19 executions yesterday already had been announced. And in addition, at least six others were sentenced to death, while 36 more were sent to prison. Meanwhile, Berlin announces that a military court in Bulgaria has imposed the death sentence on a former Bulgarian minister to Belgrade, Kosta Todorov. A former Bulgarian deputy also was sentenced to die. The crimes of both are said to have been that they made Bulgarian language broadcasts recently over the London radio. From Sofia, dispatches tell of four members of a labor organization being sentenced to death. This indicates that the situation is far from calm in Bulgaria, for the four were convicted of causing train wrecks, of blasting bridges, and burning stores of grain. Some news from our neighbors to the south, from Buenos Aires. One leading Argentine socialist wants his country to pitch in with the nations fighting for the defeat of Germany. He's Nicolas Repetto, who ran for president of Argentina on the socialist ticket in 1937. He calls the Argentine administration weak in its attitude on German embassy activities. We've given you a roundup of reports from Europe, and now let's tell you what's going on across that other ocean, the Pacific. In just a few seconds, we will bring you direct reports from the Far East.
Now we hear from our NBC reporter in the Netherlands, East Indies. Go ahead, Batavia.
Hello, NBC. This is Sidney Albright speaking in Batavia, Java. The time is 7:53 Monday morning. The immediate danger of war in the Pacific area has practically removed any discussion of the Russian situation from the newspapers in Java. Prominent Dutchmen are in full sympathy with America's efforts to reach an agreement with Japan, but at the same time, they are convinced that the United States should not give in on even one single point of appeasement. They firmly believe that the only form of diplomacy the Japanese understand and bow to is a strong and uncompromising attitude. If this policy should fail and eventually lead to war, then the inevitable must be faced. The general opinion seems to be that America must fight Japan sooner or later, and that only a war will break the power of the Japanese military party. With the final collapse of this group, peace in the Pacific is guaranteed for many years to come. Although no official statements have been made, it appears the Dutch authorities would welcome the opportunity of standing shoulder to shoulder with the United States in any measures considered necessary for the maintenance of the status quo in the Pacific. It is also felt that America's position as regards the European situation would be decidedly strengthened by a termination of Japan's ambitions in East Asia, thus permitting the removal of the American fleet from the Pacific to the Atlantic, where its use would be far more advantageous to the Democratic cause. Commenting editorially, one of Batavia's newspapers expressed the belief that if Japan has reason to fear that an attack on Siberia will involve them in war with England and possibly the United States, they would hesitate to take such a fatal step, but would then, following the lines of least resistance, again turn their eyes southward. Despite the fact that England and the Netherlands are allies in the European conflict, England has never declared that the British Empire would actually protect the Netherlands East Indies in case of an invasion. For this reason, the Japanese militarists may consider their best chances for the furtherance of their aggressive aims are in this direction, either by means of an attack on Borneo or on Java proper. Furthermore, it is generally known that although the ABCD front exists in spirit, there is no written agreement, and therefore nothing actually binding, which, in summary, means that this archipelago must defend itself unless America or England should voluntarily intervene. It was hoped that some positive understanding would be reached in this regard when Sir Robert Brooke Popham conferred here last week with the late Commander-in-Chief of the Indies Army, General Baron Scott, whose tragic death occurred only a few minutes after his conference with Brooke Popham. The British Commander-in-Chief left immediately for Australia, but has not as yet divulged the nature of his talk with General Baron Scott. I now return you to NBC.
Now, for a report from the capital of China, we take you to Chongqing.
In Chongqing, China's wartime capital. This is actually 7:46 in the morning here, Monday morning. The opinion in Chongqing is split on the significance of the cabinet reshuffle in Tokyo. On the one hand, it is believed that Japan is nothing. That the new cabinet, though virtually a war cabinet, is nevertheless designed primarily to steer the anti-aggression powers into appeasers or earth. It is argued, however, that Japan is in no position to follow through with that threat of or earth. As long as the China war, weapon edict number one, remains unsettled, immobilizing upwards of 1 million men on the China front. See that as
ladies and gentlemen, we regret that circumstances beyond our control make it impossible at this time to bring you our scheduled report from Chongqing, China. We now return you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
Back in New York, and before we conclude this broadcast period, may we bring you some more bulletins which have come into the newsroom here from Cairo. A British communique today disclosed an attack by naval planes Friday night on an Italian convoy in the central Mediterranean. The war bulletin says direct torpedo hits were scored on 2 merchantmen. And from Rome, Premier Mussolini's editorial spokesman Virginio Guida apparently is preparing the Italian people for an announcement of the torpedoing of the American destroyer Carney. He's telling his readers that new incidents can be considered as acts of self-defense by German submarines. News of the Carney attack has not been published in Italy. Without mentioning the Carney, Guida said today the previous incident involving the United States destroyer Greer showed the interpretation which has given new affairs of this kind. Mussolini's mouthpiece added, "It is now clear North American bellicosity is moving toward aggression against the Axis." A bulletin out of Berlin. German military quarters claim that they have smashed through an especially strong defense system on the central Russian front, but they withhold all further description. The threatening situation around Moscow raises the possibility that the claims refer to Moscow's outer defenses. But all the Germans' remark is that the new position is being held despite fierce counterattacks by the Red Army. The German news agency says that Soviet defenses have been pierced at several points, despite stubborn fighting. Earlier, the Nazi high command said that elite troops had taken Tangonrag on the north shore of the Sea of Azov. This brings them into striking position before Moscow, 30 miles away. Rostov is the gateway to the Caucasian oil fields, the major objective in the southern drive. With this report, NBC ends this regular Sunday foreign news roundup. Speakers heard tonight were Martin Agronsky from Turkey, Charles Lanius in Switzerland, Fred Bates speaking from London, Paul Archinard in Vichy, Sidney Albright in Batavia, and Harrison Foreman from Chongqing, China. Ben Grauer speaking. This is the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company.